He kept his silence, but he would not move, and his eyes were full of poison as they rode away. Soon he was lost in the tall grass. When they could not see him anymore, Danny grew afraid. Will he find his way back? She asked Sir Jorah as they rode.
Even a man as blind as your brother should be able to follow our trail, he replied.
He is proud. He may be too ashamed to come back. Jorah laughed.
Where else should he go if he cannot find the Khalasar? The Khalasar will most surely find him. It's hard to drown in the Dothraki Sea, child.
Danny saw the truth of that. The Khalasar was like a city on the march, but it did not march blindly. Always scouts ranged far ahead of the main column, alert for any sign of game or prey or enemies, while outriders guarded their flanks. They missed nothing. Not here in this land, the place where they had come from. These plains were a part of them, and of her now.
I hit him, she said, wonder in her voice.
Now that it was over, it seemed like a strange dream that she had dreamed. Sir Jorah, do you think...
He'll be so angry when he gets back, she shivered.
I woke the dragon, didn't I? Sir Jorah snorted.
Can you wake the dead girl? Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon, and he died on the Trident. Viserys is less than the shadow of a snake.
His blunt words startled her. It seemed as though all the things she had always believed were suddenly called into question.
You swore him your sword. That I did, girl, Sir Jorah said. And if your brother is the shadow of a snake, what does that make his servants?
His voice was bitter. He is still the true king.
He is.
Jorah pulled up his horse and looked at her.
Truth now, would you want to see Viserys sit a throne?
Danny thought about it.
He would not be a very good king, would he? There have been worse, but not many.
The knight gave his heels to his mount and started off again. Danny rode close beside him. Still, she said, the common people are waiting for him. Magister Illyrio says they are sewing dragon banners and praying for Viserys to return from across the narrow sea to free them.
The common people pray for rain, healthy children, and a summer that never ends, Sir Jorah told her. It's no matter to them if the High Lords play their Game of Thrones, so long as they're left in peace. He gave a shrug. They never are.
Danny rode along quietly for a time, working his words like a puzzle box. It went against everything that Viserys had ever told her. To think that the people could care so little whether a true king or a usurper reigned over them. Yet the more she thought on Jorah's words, the more they rang of truth. What do you pray for, Sir Jorah? She asked him.
Home, he said. His voice was thick with longing.
I pray for home, too, she told him, believing it. Sir Jorah laughed.
Look around you, then, Khaleesi.
But it was not the plains Danny saw then. It was King's Landing and the great red keep that Aegon the Conqueror had built. It was Dragonstone, where she had been born. In her mind's eye, they burned with a thousand lights, a fire blazing in every window. In her mind's eye, all the doors were red. My brother will never take back the Seven Kingdoms, Danny said. She had known that for a long time, she realized. She had known it all her life. Only she had never let herself say the words, even in a whisper. But now, she said them for Jorah Mormont and all the world to hear. Sir Jorah gave her a measuring look.
You think not?
He could not lead an army, even if my lord husband gave him one. Danny said, he has no coin, and the only knight who follows him reviles him as less than a snake. The Dothraki make mock of his weakness. He will never take us home.
Wise child, the knight smiled.
I'm no child, she told him fiercely. Her heels pressed into the sides of her mount, rousing the silver to a gallop. Faster and faster she raced, leaving Jorah and Ira and the others far behind. the warm wind in her hair and the setting sun red on her face. By the time she reached the Kalasar, it was dusk. The slaves had erected her tent by the shore of a spring-fed pool. She could hear rough voices from the woven grass palace on the hill. Soon there would be laughter when the men of her caste told the story of what had happened in the grasses today. By the time Viserys came limping back among them, every man, woman, and child in the camp would know him for a walker. There were no secrets in the Kalasar. Dany gave the silver over to the slaves for grooming and entered her tent. It was cool and dim beneath the silk. As she let the door flap close behind her, Dany saw a finger of dusty red light reach out to touch her dragon's eggs across the tent. For an instant, 1,000 droplets of scarlet flame swam before her eyes. She blinked, and they were gone. Stone, she told herself. They are only stone. Even Illyrio said so. The dragons are all dead. She put her palm against the black egg. Fingers spread gently across the curve of the shell. The stone was warm, almost hot. The sun, Dany whispered. The sun warmed them as they rode. She commanded her handmaidens to prepare her a bath. Doria built a fire outside the tent, while Iri and Jiqui fetched the big copper tub, another bridal gift, from the pack horses and carried water from the pool. When the bath was steaming, Iri helped her into it and climbed in after her. Have you ever seen a dragon? She asked, as Iri scrubbed her back and Jiqui sluiced sand from her hair. She had heard that the first dragons had come from the east, from the shadowlands beyond Ashai and the islands of the Jade Sea. Perhaps some were still living there, in realms strange and wild. Dragons are gone, Khaleesi, Iri said. Dead, agreed Jiqui, long and long ago. Viserys had told her that the last Targaryen dragons had died no more than a century and a half ago, during the reign of Aegon III, who was called the Dragonbane. That did not seem so long ago to Dany. Everywhere, she said, disappointed, even in the east. Magic had died in the west when the doom fell on Valyria and the lands of the Long Summer, and neither spell-forged steel, nor storm singers, nor dragons could hold it back. But Dany had always heard that the east was different. It was said that manacores prowled the islands of the Jade Sea, that basilisks infested the jungles of Yi Ti, that spellsingers, warlocks, and aeromancers practiced their arts openly in Ashai, while shadowbinders and blood mages worked terrible sorceries in the black of night. Why shouldn't there be dragons, too? No dragon, Iri said. Brave men kill them. For dragon, terrible evil beasts, it is known. It is known, agreed Jiqui. A trader from Karth once told me that dragons came from the moon, Blondoria said as she warmed a towel over the fire. Jiqui and Iri were of an age with Dany, Dothraki girls taken as slaves when Drogo destroyed their father's Kalasar. Doria was older, almost 20. Magister Illyrio had found her in a pleasure house in Lyse. Silvery wet hair tumbled over her eyes as Dany turned her head, curious. The moon? He told me the moon was an egg, Khaleesi, the Lysine girl said. Once there were two moons in the sky, but one wandered too close to the sun and cracked from the heat. 1,000,000 dragons poured forth and drank the fire of the sun. That is why dragons breathe flame. One day the other moon will kiss the sun too, and then it will crack, and the dragons will return. The two Dothraki girls giggled and laughed.
You are foolish, straw-haired slave, Iri said. Moon is no egg. Moon is God. Woman, wife of sun. It is known. It is known, Jiqui agreed.
Danny's skin was flushed and pink when she climbed from the tub. Jiqui laid her down to oil her body and scrape the dirt from her paws. Afterward, Iri sprinkled her with spice flour and cinnamon, while Doria brushed her hair until it shone like spun silver. She thought about the moon and eggs and dragons. Her supper was a simple meal of fruit and cheese and fry bread, with a jug of honeyed wine to wash it down. Doria, stay and eat with me, Danny commanded when she sent her other handmaids away. The Lycian girl had hair the color of honey and eyes like the summer sky. She lowered those eyes when they were alone. You honor me, Khaleesi, she said. But it was no honor, only service. Long after the moon had risen, they sat together, talking. That night when Khal Drogo came, Danny was waiting for him. He stood in the door of her tent and looked at her with surprise. She rose slowly and opened her sleeping silks and let them fall to the ground. This night, we must go outside, my lord, she told him, for the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. Khal Drogo followed her out into the moonlight, the bells in his hair tinkling softly. A few yards from her tent was a bed of soft grass, and it was there that Danny drew him down. When he tried to turn her over, she put a hand to his chest. No, she said, this night I would look on your face. There is no privacy in the heart of the Khalasar. Danny felt the eyes on her as she undressed him, heard the soft voices as she did the things that Doria had told her to do. It was nothing to her. Was she not Khaleesi? His were the only eyes that mattered. And when she mounted him, she saw something there that she had never seen before. She rode him as fiercely as ever she had ridden her silver. And when the moment of his pleasure came, Khal Drogo called out her name. They were on the far side of the Dothraki Sea when Jiqui brushed the soft swell of Danny's stomach with her fingers and said, Khaleesi, you are with child. I know, Danny told her. It was her 14th name day. Bran. In the yard below, Rickon ran with the wolves. Bran watched him from his window seat. Wherever the boy went, Grey Wind was there first, loping ahead to cut him off, until Rickon saw him, screamed in delight, and went pelting off in another direction. Shaggy Dog ran at his heels, spinning and snapping if the other wolves came too close. His fur had darkened until he was all black, and his eyes were green fire. Bran Summer came last. He was silver and smoke, with eyes of yellow gold that saw all there was to see. Smaller than Grey Wind and more wary, Bran thought he was the smartest of the litter. He could hear his brother's breathless laughter as Rickon dashed across the hard-packed earth on little baby legs. His eyes stung. He wanted to be down there, laughing and running. Angry at the thought, Bran knuckled away the tears before they could fall. His eighth name day had come and gone. He was almost a man grown now, too old to cry. It was just a lie, he said bitterly, remembering the crow from his dream. I can't fly. I can't even run.
Crows are all liars,
old Nan agreed from the chair where she sat doing her needlework.
I know a story about a crow.
I don't want any more stories, Bran snapped, his voice petulant. He had liked old Nan and her stories once, before, but it was different now.
They left her with him all day now to watch over him and clean him and keep him from being lonely. But she just made it worse. I hate your stupid stories. The old woman smiled at him toothlessly.
My stories? No, my little lord, not mine. These stories are before me and after me, before you too.
She was a very ugly old woman, Bran thought spitefully. Shrunken and wrinkled, almost blind, too weak to climb stairs, with only a few wisps of white hair left to cover a mottled pink scalp. No one really knew how old she was, but his father said she had been called Old Nan even when he was a boy. She was the oldest person in Winterfell for certain. Maybe the oldest person in the Seven Kingdoms. Nan had come to the castle as a wet nurse for a Brandon Stark whose mother had died birthing him. He had been an older brother of Lord Rickard, Bran's grandfather, or perhaps a younger brother, or a brother of Lord Rickard's father. Sometimes old Nan told it one way and sometimes another. In all the stories, the little boy died at three of a summer chill. But old Nan stayed on at Winterfell with her own children. She had lost both her sons to the war when King Robert won the throne. And her grandson was killed on the walls of Pyke during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion. Her daughters had long ago married and moved away and died. All that was left of her own blood was Hodor, the simple-minded giant who worked in the stables. But old Nan just lived on and on, doing her needlework and retelling her stories. I don't care whose stories they are, Bran told her. I hate them. He didn't want stories, and he didn't want old Nan. He wanted his mother and father. He wanted to go running with Summer loping beside him. He wanted to climb the broken tower and feed corn to the crows. He wanted to ride his pony again with his brothers. He wanted it to be the way it had been before.
I know a story about a boy who hated stories, old Nan said with her stupid little smile, her needles moving all the while, click, click, click,
until Bran was ready to scream at her. It would never be the way it had been, he knew. The crow had tricked him into flying, but when he woke up, he was broken, and the world was changed. They had all left him, his father and his mother and his sisters, and even his bastard brother John. His father had promised he would ride a real horse to King's Landing, but they'd gone without him. Maester Lewin had sent a bird off to Lord Eddard with a message and another to Mother and a third to John on the wall, but there had been no answers.
Oft-times the birds are lost, child, the maester had told him. There's many a mile and many a hawk between here and King's Landing. The message may not have reached them.
Yet to Bran, it felt as if they had all died while he had slept. Or perhaps Bran had died, and they had forgotten him. Jory and Ser Roddick and Vaean Poole had gone too, and Holland and Harwin and Fat Tom, and a quarter of the guard. Only Rob and Baby Rickon were still here, and Rob was changed. He was Rob the Lord now, or trying to be. He wore a real sword and never smiled. His days were spent drilling the guard and practicing his swordplay, making the yard ring with the sound of steel as Bran watched forlornly from his window. At night, he closeted himself with Maester Lewin, talking or going over account books. Sometimes he would ride out with Hallis Mollen and be gone for days at a time, visiting distant holdfasts. Whenever he was away more than a day, Rickon would cry and ask Bran if Rob was ever coming back. Even when he was home at Winterfell, Rob the Lord seemed to have more time for Hallis Mollen and Theon Greyjoy than he ever did for his brothers.
I could tell you a story about Brandon the Builder, old Ned said. That was always your favorite.
Thousands and thousands of years ago, Brandon the Builder had raised Winterfell, and some said the wall. Bran knew the story, but it had never been his favorite. Maybe one of the other Brandons had liked that story. Sometimes Nan would talk to him as if he were her Brandon, the baby she had nursed all those years ago,
and sometimes she confused him with his uncle Brandon, who was killed by the Mad King before Bran was even born. She had lived so long, Mother had told him once, that all the Brandon Starks had become one person in her head. "That's not my favorite," he said. "My favorites were the scary ones." He heard some sort of commotion outside and turned back to the window. Rickon was running across the yard toward the gatehouse, the wolves following him. But the tower faced the wrong way for Bran to see what was happening. He smashed a fist on his thigh in frustration and felt nothing.
"Oh, my sweet summer child," old Nan said quietly. "What do you know of fear? Fear is for the winter, my little lord, when the snows fall 100 feet deep and the ice wind comes howling out of the north. Fear is for the long night, when the sun hides its face for years at a time, and little children are born and live and die all in darkness, while the dire wolves grow gaunt and hungry, and the white walkers move through the woods."
"You mean the others?" Bran said querulously.
"The others," old Nan agreed. "Thousands and thousands of years ago, a winter fell that was cold and hard and endless beyond all memory of man. There came a night that lasted a generation, and kings shivered and died in their castles, even as the swine herds in their hovels. Women smothered their children rather than see them starve, and cried and felt their tears freeze on their cheeks."
Her voice and her needles fell silent, and she glanced up at Bran with pale, filmy eyes and asked,
"So, child, this is the sort of story you like?"
"Well," Bran said reluctantly, "yes, only..." Old Nan nodded.
"In that darkness, the others came for the first time," she said as her needles went click, click, click. "They were cold things, dead things, that hated iron and fire and the touch of the sun and every creature with hot blood in its veins. They swept over whole forests and cities and kingdoms, felled heroes and armies by the score, riding their pale dead horses and leading hosts of the slain. All the swords of men could not stay their advance, and even maidens and suckling babies found no pity in them. They hunted the maids through frozen forests and fed their dead servants on the flesh of human children."
A voice had dropped very low, almost to a whisper, and Bran found himself leaning forward to listen.
"Now these were the days before the Andals came, and long before the women fled across the narrow sea from the cities of the Rhoyn and the 100 kingdoms of those times were the kingdoms of the first men who had taken these lands from the children of the forest. Yet here and there, in the vastness of the woods, the children still lived in their wooden cities and hollow hills, and the faces in the trees kept watch. So as cold and death filled the earth, the last hero determined to seek out the children in the hopes that their ancient magics could win back what the armies of men had lost. He set out into the dead lands with a sword, a horse, a dog, and 12 companions. For years he searched until he despaired of ever finding the children of the forest in their secret cities. One by one, his friends died, and his horse, and finally even his dog. And his sword froze so hard, the blade snapped when he tried to use it. And the other smelled the hot blood in him. and came silent on his trail, stalking him with packs of pale white spiders, big as hounds.
The door opened with a bang, and Bran's heart leapt up into his mouth in sudden fear. But it was only Maester Lewin, with Hodor looming on the stairway behind him. "Hodor," the stable boy announced, as was his custom, smiling hugely at them all. Maester Lewin was not smiling.
"We have visitors," he announced, "and your presence is required, Bran."
"I'm listening to a story now," Bran complained.
"Stories wait, my little lord, and when you come back to them, why, here they are,"
old Nan said.
"Visitors are not so patient, and oft-times they bring stories of their own."
"Who is it?" Bran asked Maester Lewin.
"Tyrion Lannister and some men of the Night's Watch, with a word from your brother John. Rob is meeting with them now. Hodor, will you help Bran down the hall?"
"Hodor,"
Hodor agreed happily.
He ducked to get his great shaggy head under the door.
Hodor was nearly 7 feet tall. It was hard to believe that he was the same blood as old Nan. Bran wondered if he would shrivel up as small as his great-grandmother when he was old. It did not seem likely, even if Hodor lived to be 1,000. Hodor lifted Bran as easily as if he were a bale of hay and cradled him against his massive chest. He always smelled faintly of horses, and it was not a bad smell. His arms were thick with muscle and matted with brown hair.
"Hodor," he said again.
Theon Greyjoy had once commented that Hodor did not know much, but no one could doubt that he knew his name. Old Nan had cackled like a hen when Bran told her that and confessed that Hodor's real name was Walder. No one knew where Hodor had come from, she said, but when he started saying it, they started calling him by it. It was the only word he had. They left old Nan in the tower room with her needles and her memories. Hodor hummed tunelessly as he carried Bran down the steps and through the gallery, with Maester Lewin following behind, hurrying to keep up with the stable boy's long strides. Rob was seated in father's high seat, wearing ringmail and boiled leather, and the stern face of Rob the Lord. Theon Greyjoy and Halas Mollen stood behind him. A dozen guardsmen lined the grey stone walls beneath tall, narrow windows. In the centre of the room, the dwarf stood with his servants and four strangers in the black of the Night's Watch. Bran could sense the anger in the hall at the moment Hodor carried him through the doors. "Any man of the Night's Watch is welcome here at Winterfell for as long as he wishes to stay," Rob was saying with the voice of Rob the Lord. His sword was across his knees, the steel bare for all the world to see. Even Bran knew what it meant to greet a guest with an unsheathed sword.
"Any man of the Night's Watch," the dwarf repeated, "but not me. Do I take your meaning, boy?"
Rob stood and pointed at the little man with his sword. "I am the Lord while my mother and father are away, Lannister. I am not your boy."
"If you are a lord, you might learn a lord's courtesy," the little man replied, ignoring the sword point in his face. "Your bastard brother has all your father's graces, it would seem."
"John," Bran gasped out from Hodor's arms. The dwarf turned to look at him.
"So it is true, the boy lives. I could scarce believe it. You Starks are hard to kill."
"You Lannister had best remember that," Rob said, lowering his sword. "Hodor, bring my brother here."
"Hodor,"
Hodor said as he trotted forward smiling and set Bran in the high seat of the Starks, where the lords of Winterfell had sat since the days when they called themselves the Kings of the North. The seat was cold stone, polished smooth by countless bottoms. The carved heads of direwolves snarled on the ends of its massive arms. Bran clasped them as he sat, his useless legs dangling. The great seat made him feel half a baby. Rob put a hand on his shoulder. You said you had business with Bran. Well, here is Lannister. Bran was uncomfortably aware of Tyrion Lannister's eyes. One was black and one was green, and both were looking at him, studying him, weighing him.
I am told you are quite a climber, Bran, the little man said at last. Tell me, how is it you happened to fall that day?
I never, Bran insisted. He never fell. Never, never, never.
The child does not remember anything of the fall or the climb that came before it, said Maester Lewin gently. Curious, said Tyrion Lannister.
My brother is not here to answer questions, Lannister, Rob said curtly. Do your business, be on your way.
I have a gift for you, the dwarf said to Bran. Do you like to ride, boy?
Maester Lewin came forward.
My lord, the child has lost the use of his legs. He cannot sit a horse.
Nonsense, said Lannister.
With the right horse and the right saddle, even a cripple can ride.
The word was a knife through Bran's heart. He felt tears come unbidden to his eyes.
I'm not a cripple.
Then I am not a dwarf, the dwarf said with a twist of his mouth.
My father will rejoice to hear it.
Greyjoy laughed.
What sort of horse and saddle are you suggesting? Maester Lewin said.
A smart horse, Lannister replied.
The boy cannot use his legs to command the animal, so you must shape the horse to the rider. Teach it to respond to the reins, to the voice. I would begin with an unbroken yearling, with no old training to be unlearned.
He drew a roll of paper from his belt.
Give this to your saddler. He will provide the rest.
Maester Lewin took the paper from the dwarf's hand, curious, as a small gray squirrel. He unrolled it, studied it.
I see. You draw nicely, my lord. Yes, this ought to work. I should have thought of this myself. It came easier to me, Maester. It's not terribly unlike my own saddles.
Will I truly be able to ride? Bran asked. He wanted to believe them, but he was afraid. Perhaps it was just another lie. The crow had promised him that he could fly.
You will, the dwarf told him. And I swear to you, boy, on horseback, you will be as tall as any of them.
Robb Stark seemed puzzled. Is this some trap, Lannister? What's Bran to you? Why should you want to help him?
Your brother John has asked it of me. And I have a tender spot in my heart for cripples and bastards and broken things.
Tyrion Lannister placed a hand over his heart and grinned. The door to the yard flew open. Sunlight came streaming across the hall as Rickon burst in, breathless. The direwolves were with him. The boy stopped by the door, wide-eyed, but the wolves came on. Their eyes found Lannister, or perhaps they caught his scent. Summer began to growl first. Grey wind picked it up. They padded towards the little man, one from the right and one from the left. The wolves do not like your smell, Lannister, Theon Greyjoy commented.
Perhaps it's time I took my leave, Tyrion said.
He took a step backward, and Shaggy Dog came out of the shadows behind him, snarling. Lannister recoiled, and Summer lunged at him from the other side. He reeled away, unsteady on his feet, and Greywind snapped at his arm, teeth ripping at his sleeve and tearing loose a scrap of cloth. No! Bran shouted from the high seat as Lannister's men reached for their steel. Summer, here! Summer, to me! The direwolf heard the voice, glanced at Bran and again at Lannister. He crept backwards, away from the little man, and settled down below Bran's dangling feet. Rob had been holding his breath. He let it out with a sigh and called, Greywind! His dire wolf moved to him, swift and silent. Now there was only Shaggy Dog, rumbling at the small man, his eyes burning like green fire. Rickon, call him! Bran shouted to his baby brother, and Rickon remembered himself and screamed, Home, Shaggy Dog! Home now! The black wolf gave Lannister one final snarl and bounded off to Rickon, who hugged him tightly around the neck. Tyrion Lannister,
undid his scarf, mopped his brow, and said in a flat tone,
"How interesting."
"Are you well, my lord?" asked one of the men, his sword in hand. He glanced nervously at the direwolves as he spoke.
My sleeve is torn and my breeches are unaccountably damp. But nothing was harmed, save my dignity."
Even Rob looked shaken. "The wolves, I don't know why they did that."
"No doubt they mistook me for dinner."
Lannister bowed stiffly to Bran.
"I thank you for calling them off, young sir. I promise you they would have found me quite indigestible. And now I will be leaving, truly."
A moment, my lord," Maester Lewin said. He moved to Rob, and they huddled close together, whispering. Bran tried to hear what they were saying, but their voices were too low. Rob Stark finally sheathed his sword.
I may have been hasty with you," he said. "You've done Bran a kindness, and, well..." Rob composed himself with an effort. "The hospitality of Winterfell is yours, if you wish it, Lannister."
"Spare me your false courtesies, boy. You do not love me, and you do not want me here. I saw an inn outside your walls in the winter town. I'll find a bed there, and both of us will sleep easier. For a few coppers, I may even find a comely wench to warm the sheets for me."
He spoke to one of the Black Brothers, an old man with a twisted back and a tangled beard.
"Yarin, we go south at daybreak. You will find me on the road, no doubt."
With that, he made his exit, struggling across the hall on his short legs, past Rickon, and out of the door. His men followed. The four of the night's watch remained. Rob turned to them uncertainly.
"I've had rooms prepared, and you'll find no lack of hot water to wash off the dust of the road. I hope you will honor us at table tonight."
He spoke the words so awkwardly that even Bran took note. It was a speech he had learned, not words from the heart. But the Black Brothers thanked him all the same. Summer followed them up the tower steps as Hodor carried Bran back to his bed. Old Nan was asleep in her chair. Hodor said, "Hodor," gathered up his great-grandmother and carried her off, snoring softly while Bran lay thinking. Rob had promised that he could feast with the night's watch in the great hall. "Summer," he called. The wolf bounded up to the bed. Bran hugged him so hard he could feel the hot breath on his cheek.
"I can ride now," he whispered to his friend. "We can go hunting in the woods soon. Wait and see."
After a time, he slept. In his dream, he was climbing again, pulling himself up an ancient windowless tower, his fingers forcing themselves between blackened stones, his feet scrabbling for purchase. Higher and higher he climbed, through the clouds and into the night sky, and still the tower rose before him. When he paused to look down, his head swam dizzily, and he felt his fingers slipping. Bran cried out and clung for dear life. The earth was 1,000 miles beneath him, and he could not fly. He could not fly. He waited until his heart had stopped pounding, until he could breathe, and he began to climb again. There was no way to go but up. Far above him, outlined against a vast pale moon, he thought he could see the shapes of gargoyles. His arms were sore and aching, but he dare not rest. He forced himself to climb faster. The gargoyles watched him ascend. Their eyes glowed red as hot coals in a brazier. Perhaps once they had been lions, but now they were twisted and grotesque. Bran could hear them whispering to each other in soft stone voices terrible to hear. He must not listen, he told himself. He must not hear. So long as he did not hear them, he was safe. But when the gargoyles pulled themselves loose from the stone and padded down the side of the tower to where Bran clung, he knew he was not safe after all.
"I didn't hear," he wept as they came closer and closer. I didn't.
He woke, gasping, lost in darkness,
and saw a vast shadow looming over him. "I didn't hear," he whispered, trembling in fear. And then the shadow said, "Hodor," and lit the candle by the bedside, and Bran sighed with relief. Hodor washed the sweat from him with a warm, damp cloth and dressed him with deft and gentle hands. When it was time, he carried him down to the great hall, where a long trestle table had been set up near the fire. The lord's seat at the head of the table had been left empty, but Rob sat to the right of it, with Bran across from him. They ate suckling pig that night, and pigeon pie, and turnip soaked in butter, and afterwards the cook had promised honeycombs. Summer snatched table scraps from Bran's hand, while Grey Wind and Shaggy Dog fought over a bone in the corner. Winterfell's dogs would not come near the hall now. Bran had found that strange at first, but he was growing used to it. Yoren was senior among the Black Brothers, so the steward had seated him between Rob and Maester Lewin. The old man had a sour smell, as if he had not washed in a long time. He ripped at the meat with his teeth, cracked the ribs to suck out the marrow from the bones, and shrugged at the mention of Jon Snow. "Sir Alistair's bane," he grunted, and two of his companions shared a laugh that Bran did not understand. But when Rob asked for news of their uncle Benjen, the Black Brothers grew ominously quiet. "What is it?" Bran asked. Yoren wiped his fingers on his vest.
"There's hard news, my lords, and a cruel way to pay you for your meat and mead. But the man as asked the question must bear the answer. Stark's gone."
One of the other men said,
"The old bearer sent him out to look for Waenor Royce, and he's late returning, my lord." "Too long," Yoren said. "Most like he's dead."
"My uncle is not dead," Robb Stark said loudly, anger in his tones. He rose from the bench and laid his hand on the hilt of his sword. "Do you hear me? My uncle is not dead." His voice rang against the stone walls, and Bran was suddenly afraid. Old sour-smelling Yoren looked up at Rob, unimpressed.
"Whatever you say, my lord," he said.
He sucked at a piece of meat between his teeth. The youngest of the Black Brothers shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"There's not a man on the wall knows the haunted forest better than Benjen Stark. He'll find his way back." "Well," said Yoren, "maybe he will, and maybe he won't. Good men have gone into those woods before and never come out."
All Bran could think of was old Nan's stories of the others and the last hero, hounded through the white woods by dead men and spiders as big as hounds. He was afraid for a moment until he remembered how the story ended.
"The children will help him," he blurted. "The children of the forest."
Theon Greyjoy sniggered, and Maester Lewin said,
"Bran, the children of the forest have been dead and gone for thousands of years. All that is left of them are the faces in the trees." "Down here might be that's true, Maester," Yoren said. "But up past the wall, who's to say? Up there, a man can't always tell what's alive and what's dead."
That night, after the plates had been cleared, Rob carried Bran up to bed himself. Grey Wind led the way, and Summer came close behind. His brother was strong for his age, and Bran was as light as a bundle of rags. But the stairs were steep and dark, and Rob was breathing hard by the time they reached the top. He put Bran into bed, covered him with blankets, and blew out the candle. For a time, Rob sat beside him in the dark. Bran wanted to talk to him, but he did not know what to say.
"We'll find a horse for you, I promise," Rob whispered at last. "Are they ever coming back?" Bran asked him.
"Yes," Rob said, with such hope in his voice that Bran knew he was hearing his brother and not just Rob the Lord.
"Mother will be home soon. Maybe we can ride out to meet her when she comes. Wouldn't that surprise her to see you a horse?"
Even in the dark room, Bran could feel his brother smile. "And afterwards, we'll ride north to see the war.
We won't even tell John we're coming. We'll just be there one day. You and me. It will be an adventure.
An adventure, Bran repeated wistfully. He heard his brother sob. The room was so dark, he could not see the tears on Rob's face. So he reached out and found his hand, their fingers twined together. Eddard.
Lord Aaron's death was a great sadness for all of us, my lord, Grandmaster Pycelle said. I would be more than happy to tell you what I can of the manner of his passing. Do be seated. Would you care for refreshments? Some dates, perhaps? I have some very fine persimmons as well. Wine no longer agrees with my digestion, I fear. But I can offer you a cup of iced milk, sweetened with honey. I find it most refreshing in this heat.
There was no denying the heat. Ned could feel the silk tunic clinging to his chest. Thick, moist air covered the city like a damp woolen blanket, and the riverside had grown unruly as the poor fled their hot, airless warrens to jostle for sleeping places near the water, where the only breath of wind was to be found. That would be most kind, Ned said, seating himself. Pycelle lifted a tiny silver bell with thumb and forefinger and tinkled it gently. A slender young serving girl hurried into the solar.
Iced milk for the king's hand and myself, if you will be so kind, child. Well sweetened.
As the girl went to fetch their drinks, the Grand Maester knotted his fingers together and rested his hands on his stomach.
The small folk say that the last year of summer is always the hottest. It is not so, yet oftentimes it feels that way. Does it not? On days like this, I envy you northerners your summer snows.
The heavy jewel chain around the old man's neck clinked softly as he shifted in his seat.
To be sure, Kingmaker's summer was hotter than this one, and near as long. There were fools, even in the citadel, who took that to mean that the great summer had come at last. The summer that never ends. But in the seventh year, it broke suddenly, and we had a short autumn and a terrible long winter. Still, the heat was fierce while it lasted. Old towns teemed and sweltered by day and came alive only by night. We would walk in the gardens by the river and argue about the gods. I remember the smells of those nights, my lord, perfume and sweat, melons ripe to bursting, peaches and pomegranates, nightshade and moon bloom. I was a young man then, still forging my chain. The heat did not exhaust me as it does now.
Pycelle's eyes were so heavily lidded, he looked half asleep.
My pardons, Lord Eddard. You did not come to hear foolish meanderings of a summer forgotten before your father was born. Forgive an old man his wanderings, if you would. Minds are like swords, I do fear. The old ones go to rust. And here is our milk.
The serving girl placed the tray between them, and Pycelle gave her a smile.
Sweet child. He lifted a cup, tasted, nodded. Thank you. You may go.
When the girl had taken her leave, Pycelle peered at Ned through pale, rheumy eyes.
Now, where were we? Oh, yes, you asked about Lord Aaron.
I did. Ned sipped politely at the iced milk. It was pleasantly cold, but oversweet to his taste.
If truth be told, the hand had not quite seemed himself for some time, Pycelle said. We had sat together on council many a year, he and I, and the signs were there to read, but I put them down to the great burdens he had borne so faithfully for so long. Those broad shoulders were weighed down by all the cares of the realm, and more besides. His son was ever sickly, and his lady wife so anxious that she would scarcely let the boy out of her sight. It was enough to weary even a strong man. And the Lord John was not young. Small wonder if he seemed melancholy and tired. Or so I thought at the time. Yet now I am less certain.
He gave a ponderous shake of his head. What can you tell me of his final illness? The Grand Maester spread his hands in a gesture of helpless sorrow.
He came to me one day, asking after a certain book, as hale and healthy as ever, though it did seem to me that something was troubling him deeply. The next morning, he was twisted over in pain, too sick to rise from bed. Maester Coleman thought it was a chill on the stomach. The weather had been very hot, and the hand often iced his wine, which can upset the digestion. When Lord John continued to weaken, I went to him myself, but the guards did not grant me the power to save him.
I have heard that you sent Maester Coleman away. The Grand Maester's nod was as slow and deliberate as a glacier.
I did, and I fear the Lady Lysa will never forgive me that. Maybe I was wrong, but at the time I thought it best. Maester Coleman is like a son to me, and I yield to none in my esteem for his abilities, but he is young, and the young oft-times do not comprehend the frailty of an older body. He was purging Lord Aaron with wasting potions and pepper juice, and I feared he might kill him.
Did Lord Aaron say anything to you during his final hours? Pycelle wrinkled his brow.
In the last stages of his fever, the hand called out the name Robert several times, but whether he was asking for his son or for the king, I could not say. Lady Lysa would not permit the boy to enter the sick room for fear that he too might be taken ill. The king did come, and he sat beside the bed for hours, talking and joking of times long past, in hopes of raising Lord John's spirits. His love was fierce to see.
Was there nothing else? No final words?
When I saw that all hope had fled, I gave the hand the milk of the poppy, so he should not suffer. Just before he closed his eyes for the last time, he whispered something to the king and his lady wife, a blessing for his son. The seed is strong, he said. At the end, his speech was too slurred to comprehend. Death did not come until the next morning, but Lord John was at peace after that. He never spoke again.
Ned took another swallow of milk, trying not to gag on the sweetness of it. Did it seem to you that there was anything unnatural about Lord Aaron's death?
Unnatural?
The aged maester's voice was thin as a whisper.
No, I could not say so. Sad, for a certainty. Yet, in its own way, death is the most natural thing of all, Lord Eddard. John Aaron rests easy now, his burdens lifted at last.
This illness that took him, said Ned, have you ever seen its like before in other men?
Nearly 40 years I have been Grand Maester of the Seven Kingdoms,
Pycelle replied.
Under our good King Robert and Aerys Targaryen before him, and his father Jaehaerys the Second before him, and even for a few short months under Jaehaerys' father, Aegon the Fortunate, the fifth of his name. I have seen more of illness than I care to remember, my lord. I will tell you this. Every case is different, and every case is alike. Lord John's death was no stranger than any other.
His wife thought otherwise. The Grand Maester nodded.
I recall now, the widow is sister to your own noble wife. If an old man may be forgiven his blunt speech, let me say that grief can derange even the strongest and most disciplined of minds, and the Lady Lysa was never that. Since her last stillbirth, she has seen enemies in every shadow, and the death of her lord husband left her shattered and lost.
So you are quite certain that John Aaron died of a sudden illness?
I am, Pycelle replied gravely. If not illness, my good lord, what else could it be?
Poison? Ned suggested quietly. Pycelle's sleepy eyes flicked open. The aged maester shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
Disturbing thought. We are not the free cities where such things are common. Grand Maester Athelmure wrote that all men carry murder in their hearts, yet even so, the poisoner is beneath contempt.
He fell silent for a moment, his eyes lost in thought.
What you suggest is possible, my lord, yet I do not think it likely. Every hedge maester knows the common poisons, and Lord Aaron displayed none of the signs, and the hand was loved by all. What sort of monster in man's flesh would dare to murder such a noble lord?
I've heard it said that poison is a woman's weapon. Pycelle stroked his beard thoughtfully.
It is said, women, cravens, and eunuchs.
He cleared his throat and spat a thick glob of phlegm onto the rushes. Above them, a raven cawed loudly in the rookery.
The Lord Varys was born a slave in Lice. Did you know? Put not your trust in spiders, my lord.
That was scarcely anything Ned needed to be told. There was something about Varys that made his flesh crawl. I will remember that, maester, and I thank you for your help. I've taken enough of your time. He stood. Grand Maester Pycelle pushed himself up from his chair slowly and escorted Ned to the door.
I hope I have helped in some small way to put your mind at ease. If there is any other service I might perform, you need only ask.
One thing, Ned told him. I should be very curious to examine the book that you lent John the day before he fell ill.
I fear you will find it of little interest, Pycelle said. It was a ponderous tome by Grand Maester Malian on the lineages of the great houses.
Still, I should like to see it. The old man opened the door.
As you wish. I have it here somewhere. When I find it, I shall have it sent to your chambers straight away.
You have been most courteous, Ned told him. Then, almost as an afterthought, he said, one last question, if you would be so kind. You mentioned that the king was at Lord Aaron's bedside when he died. I wonder, was the queen with him?
Why, no, Pycelle said. She and the children were making the journey to Casterly Rock in company with their father. Lord Tywin had brought a retinue to the city for the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day, no doubt hoping to see his son, Jaime, win the champion's crown. In that, he was sadly disappointed. It failed to me to send the queen word of Lord Aaron's sudden death. Never have I sent off a bird with a heavier heart.
Dark wings, dark words, Ned muttered. It was a proverb old Nan had taught him as a boy.
So the fishwives say,
Grand Maester Pycelle agreed.
But we know it is not always so. When Maester Lewin's bird brought the word about your brand, the message lifted every true heart in the castle, did it not?
As you say, Maester.
The guards are merciful.
Pycelle bowed his head.
Come to me as often as you like, Lord Eddard. I am here to serve.
Yes, Ned thought, as the door swung shut. But whom? On the way back to his chambers, he came upon his daughter Arya on the winding steps of the Tower of the Hand, windmilling her arms as she struggled to balance on one leg. The rough stone had scuffed her bare feet. Ned stopped and looked at her. Arya? What are you doing? Sirio says a water dancer can stand on one toe for hours. Her hands flailed at the air to steady herself. Ned had to smile. Which toe, he teased.
Any toe, Arya said, exasperated with the question. She hopped from her right leg to her left, swaying dangerously before she regained her balance.
Must you do your standing here? He asked. It's a long, hard fall down these stairs.